This morning we want to talk about a topic which is not an easy topic. It is a complex topic, and it is a challenging one. My hope is that by the time we finish, we will have gained some insight, maybe even a new perspective, on an age-old question that is a very important part of our lives as thinking Jews as Avdei Hashem. And a point of departure might be a very interesting book. A very interesting book that I came across recently. And the book is entitled, if you look on page one, source number one, it's called The Wind in My Hair by Masi Alinejad. Masi Alinejad is a woman who grew up in rural Iran, in a village where she did not have a toilet in her house. She had to go to an outhouse in the middle of the night. And she was raised in an extremely traditional family. And she grew up in Iran over the last several decades and came to a crusade, you could even call it. Because as she grew up, with something that she took for granted, which is called the hijab, which is a hair covering, she came to understand that that hair covering is not just something that is optional, but is mandatory in Iran. And over the course of her life, as she develops in this memoir, she rebels against what she calls religious coercion and the mandatory requirement to cover hair with a hijab. It's a very interesting book. It's actually extremely current because last week there was a woman in Iran who was arrested and incarcerated for taking a video of herself dancing in public. And then this sparked a whole set of international protests, especially online and social media. And this woman, Masi Alinejad, is into it because she has a ton of followers. And the question that we can think about when we hear a story like this is, how do we feel about this? What do we think about it? What would we do? If we had the ideal halachic society, if we had a state, let's say, that operated according to the whole principles of the halacha, at a time where the Beis Din, the rabbinical court, was guiding every aspect of our lives, so would we do this? Would we incarcerate people for violating the halacha? It's a good question. And when we hear this story, I venture to guess that many people in this room bristle viscerally at the thought of being coerced by a state into observing the halacha. And part of that actually comes from the context in which we live. We live in a modern era, in a modern time, in a modern Western context. And there is an Israeli scholar, his name is Meir Seidler, and he observed in this article that you see, Maharal and Religious Coercion, he says this is part and parcel of the concept of what it means to be modern. Modern meaning post-enlightenment. By negation in principle of religious coercion, which is quite obviously part and parcel of modern thought, I mean that what for generations was accepted as God's undisputed right, namely to impose a heteronomous legislation upon mankind. Because since the advent of the modern era became despicable and loathsome. The central political demand of the Enlightenment was the demand for the separation of state and religion. The philosophical basis for this political demand was the illegitimacy of religious coercion. So this is a challenge for us. How do we, as modern people, and at the same time, as devout followers of the Ribbono Shel Olam and people who are committed fully to the world of halacha and what the Ribbono Shel Olam expects of us, how do we put this together? Because on one hand, if someone were to ask you, what is the Jewish view? What does the halacha say? What does our Masorah say about religious coercion? You would say, well, it has a pretty long-standing history. And it's not only beyond our time and beyond Jews, it's universal. Because the Pasuk tells us in number 3, when Ribbono Shel Olam created mankind, Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Adam Lemar Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel. God commanded Adam HaRishon. The word mitzvah does not mean a good deed. It does not. It means a commandment. It doesn't mean a suggestion. It doesn't mean something to be taken under advisement. It means you must do this. All of humanity is commanded. But it's not just in a general sense. Many of you are probably familiar with this Gemara in source number 4, and if not in text, in concept. The Torah describes, when we stood at Sinai, we stood Vayisyatzvu Besachtis Har. So this is the mountain. Besachtis Har means in the underneath of the mountain. It should have said we stood at the foot of the mountain. It doesn't say. It says we said Besachtis Har. Amar Avavdimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa. Malamid, it's teaching us, 4th source, 2nd line. Shekafo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es Har Aleim Es Har Kegigis. God put the mountain over our head like a barrel. Va'omer lehem, and he said to them, Chever, you have a choice. Imatim makablim ha-Torah mutav. If you take the Torah, great. Ve'im lav, and if not, shom tehei kvuraschem. That's where you will be buried. This sounds like the old west side, the south side, the whatever side it is that the, you know, the Chever lived on where they were doing the thing in the mafia days of Chicago. Wherever it was. The southwest side. We'll cover all the bases. No, Mrs. Poland is saying it wasn't the southwest side. The west side. The west side. Whatever it is. The northwest. I'm not going to get involved in this. You could fight it out with the people who lived on the south side because there's the people on the west side. I'm getting it. After 10 years. So how do we understand that? What kind of a choice was that? So we got the Torah. Okay, but we were coerced. What kind of a choice is that? This is a pasuk in Yechezkel in number 5 that you shudder when you read it. It is in the context of a very severe and strict perspective. And the Ribbono Shel Olam tells us, it's hard to even read the words, Chai Oni Ne'um Hashem. Hashem Elokim Imlo B'yad Chazaka Uvizroa Nituya Uvechema Shfucha Emloch Aleichem. God says, I will rule over you with an outstretched arm. That's already a very bad reference, because when did we see that same outstretched arm? A long time ago, against people we don't want to be associated with. And with Chema Shfucha, poured out wrath, God says, you cannot run away from me. This becomes institutionalized in a pasuk, number 6, Shoftim v'shotim titan lechom b'chol she'arecha. You should appoint judges. And judges, well, not exactly judges and judges. It says shoftim v'shotrim. Asher Hashem Elokecha nosin l'chol l'shvatecha v'shavtu es ha'am mishpat tzedek. They should judge the people with justice. Well, what are shoftim and shotrim? A shofet is a judge. It's the judicial. It's the judiciary branch. But in halacha, the judiciary is inextricably linked with the executive branch. The shotrim, that's the Department of Justice. And they work together. It's a different kind of structure. The shoftim, the truth is, they're also the legislators and the judiciary. And they work hand in hand with the shotrim. If you turn the page, the Rambam tells, turn the packet over. The Rambam tells us, you know, the Rambam lived 1135 till 1204, you see his handwriting on the left side. This is a Xerox copy of number 7 from the Frankel edition of the Rambam. It's the most authoritative, critical edition of the Rambam. The Rambam wrote the corpus of all of Torah Shebaal Peh, so to speak. He says, all you need is a Tanakh and my book. My book includes all the mitzvos. So it's called the Mishnah Torah. So he wrote an introduction to that called the Sefer Mitzvot. He's going to enumerate what are the 613 mitzvot. So the Rambam says in Mitzvah Kuf Ayin Vav 176, he should sivonu limnos Shoftim v'shotrim. We were commanded to appoint judges and enforcers. Sheyachrichu lasos mitzvas haTorah. That should compel people to observe the mitzvahs of the Torah. And to return those who stray from the way of truth to the Torah. That people should be stood up and the breach. It shouldn't be left up to every person. Are you going to do it? Are you not going to do it? No, no, no. We're going to have a system. And the Rambam takes it one step even further in Hilchas Yom Tov. Now, the Rambam in Hilchas Yom Tov is often quoted because there he says, it's beautiful mitzvah to have Simchas Yom Tov, and if you have a wife, you should buy her jewelry, kefi mamono, the Rambam says, according to what you can afford. Then you should make sure to buy things for your children, everything. Everyone loves that Rambam. What people do not quote often is this Rambam, just a little bit later, in Halacha Chaf Aleph, where the Rambam says, Chayovin bezdin lahamid shotrin beregolim. The rabbinic court is obligated to establish, to stand guards on the holidays. Sheyu mesavavim umechapsim beginos ubepardesim ve'al hanahoros. That they should circulate around the parks and the vineyards and the rivers, the hangout spots. My mother-in-law is the principal of a day school. She's getting an idea from this Rambam already, I can see. We're going to have the tznius police. They're going to be going to the parks and to the hangouts and to the bars, and we're going to make sure that there's no frivolity, there's no hanging around, there's no... That's what it says. And we know from the Gemara in Ksuvos, Daf Pei Vav, that there is a general principle called Kofin Ala Mitzvos. The Gemara says if a person comes out and says, you know, I decided I'm taking a year off from Pesach. I'm done. Obviously, it's the man who says that because he's tired of schlepping matzah. You know, getting it from the car in that brown box without breaking all the matzahs. He says, I can't handle it. It's too much. It's, I have too many nerves from the shlemus, and then I'm searching for the broken matzahs. He says, I'm not doing it this year. I'm not buying matzah. So somebody will notify the local Besdin, and they will call him into Besdin. And they will enforce, they will make sure in old Chicago fashion that this person is very cautious and very scrupulous about being mekayim, the mitzvah of matzah. The Rambam codifies this specifically. It's well known in the context of gerushin. If you have a husband who is recalcitrant and his wife is expecting and awaiting a get. Now today, I'm not endorsing what happened in certain communities east of here, which led to an FBI sting and involved the back of people's vans and unsavory practices like cattle prodding and things like that. But in principle, if you have a husband who's going to keep his wife chained, so the Besdin would make sure, again, not today, but in Israel, it's a law. A husband would be incarcerated for being ma'agin his wife. So this seems pretty strict on the coercion side. There's not a lot of autonomy and flexibility and choice. It is what it is, and you got to do it. However, that's why you have one big however, because if you leave now, you might miss something. It seems, from a different perspective, that volition and choice and autonomy is actually essential to our Avodas Hashem. And it begins at the beginning with what it means to be human. There is a great, prominent psychiatrist. I think he just made Aliyah from Teaneck. He spent many decades in Pittsburgh. Before that, he was a great rabbinic master in Milwaukee. He studied in Marquette. And you see his picture. I love this picture from Life magazine. His name is Rav Shia Tversky, also known as Dr. Abraham J. Tversky. How many people in the 50s and 60s wore a white giant koppel to work in Marquette? It's awesome. Dr. Tversky has over 60 volumes that he's published. And a lot of them are about spirituality and the sense of self and what it means to be human. And in one of his works, it's a book called Tversky on Spirituality. It is what it says it is. He talks about the role of bechira chofshis, of free choice, of volition. And he points out that free choice is actually what distinguishes us as human beings from animals. It says animals act strictly based on instinct, but we have the gift of choice. He says that some philosophers deny that man has the freedom of choice and contend that a person has a number of impulses and ideas, etc., etc. Five lines in, Judaism categorically rejects this concept, which by denying free will essentially reduces man to an animal level. This is what it means to be human. And you know who said this? There was a great Gaon. He lived in Dvinsk. His name was Rav Meir Simcha. Rav Meir Simcha, a Kohen who authored the Meshech Chachma. He says on the bottom, do you know what it means when God said, Nase Adam Bitzalmenu, let us make man in our image? He says, Hatzelem ho Eloki hu habechira hachofshis. What it means to be created in the image of God means to have free choice. God had choice whether he would create the world or not create the world. So we fall in the image of Hashem Yisbarach. He had a choice, so we have a choice. That's what it means to be human. Turn the page. It's not just, of course, what it means to be human. It's what it means to be in the covenant with Hashem Yisbarach. At the end of the story of the revelation at Sinai, the Pasuk says, Vayikach Sefer Abis, Moshe Rabbeinu took the covenant, the book of the covenant from Sinai, Vayikra Ba'ozni Ha'am Vayomru, and they said, famously, Kol Asher Diber Hashem, Na'aseh V'nishma. And Chazal are very into Nasa V'nishma, as many of you are well aware. We got crowns from Nasa V'nishma, we make posters about Nasa V'nishma, we tell all the kids. That's a big deal. It's part of what the experience of Sinai was meant to be. So being human and being Jewish is about having a choice. And we are rewarded and we are praised for making that choice by saying Nasa V'nishma. Sounds like it wouldn't have been good enough otherwise. The truth is that that same Gemara that described, we stood at Har Sinai Vayisyatzvu Besachti Sahar, if you look, Rav Mendel Kasher, Zichrono Livracha, a great genius, great giant, the last century, he has a compendium of Midrashim and explanations on the Chumash that's like this wide. It's an enormous set called Torah Shlema. And in the Torah Shlema, he quotes a Mechilta, and he puts it on this Pasuk. Torah Shlema quotes from this Mechilta, I just got it from that book. Malameh Shinitla Shahar, it shows you that the mountain uprooted Mimakomo, and what happened? Vikarvu Va'amdu Tacha Sahar. We came and stood under the mountain. He didn't hold the mountain over us with a threat. We came and stood under the mountain. Why would you come and stand others under something that's over your head? What might that look like, the image on the left side of this page? That might look like a chuppah. If you were Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, and writing a book on marriage, that might be what you would write. And it quotes a beautiful pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Yonasi Bechag VeHasela. We're in the cleft of the rock. It's like we're being embraced and protected. It's not a threat. It's a protective cover. What does the Gemara say about Kaf Aleihem Har Kegigis? Let's go back. We skip the end of the Gemara. Go back to source number 4. Says the Gemara, Amar Rav Acha. Rav Acha says, 4 lines up from the bottom of this Gemara, Mikan, you know what I see from this description of Kaf Aleihem Har Kegigis? 3rd line from the bottom, Moda'a Rabba Le'oraisa. The word Moda'a is a halachic legal term. It's a Gemara in Vava Basra. The Gemara says the following. Let's say someone comes over to me and says, I like your suit a lot. I said, thank you. My wife chose it. Says, no, I like your suit a lot. And I see there's something bulging out of his jacket when he says, I like your suit a lot. And I say, I'm glad that you like my suit. I'd rather keep the pants on me than... No, he says, no. I like that suit. I'm going to buy the suit from you. I said, I don't think so. And he says, you sure? And he opens up and he has, you know, two firearms, one in each jacket. I said, okay, how much would you like to pay for it? So what we do is we're going to go to the Beis Din and we're going to write up a contract and I'm going to give him my suit. I'm going to run home, get a pair of sweatpants. But before that, I send a text message to the Beis Din, to the secretary, and said, I'd like to have a document prepared before I get there. It's called a Shtar Moda'a, an advisement bill. Because when I walk in the door, you know, they give you every time you do anything legally, they give you a million forms. I'd like to sign that form because the Shtar Moda'a is a declaration that says that what is about to happen is happening under duress. And it should not be binding. I can't get out of it right now because of his two, you know, Colt 45s, but this should not be valid. So the Gemara says, Mikan Moda Rabbala Raisa. A little secret, the Gemara says, the what you thought was the binding covenant at Sinai, it's actually legally not binding at all. It should be viewed as a commitment made under duress. So the Gemara says, Amar Rava, don't worry. Afal Pike, nonetheless, Hadar Kiblua Bimei Achashverosh. Don't worry, they re-accepted in the time of Achashverosh, which is a discussion for another time for Purim, what it means, Hadar Kiblua Bimei Achashverosh. But we see from this that this is not what we're interested in. The Gemara didn't say, yeah, you know, Kafaleim Harkigigis, it was at gunpoint, and that's fine. The Gemara says, that's not fine. That's not okay. That's not adequate. Would anybody say that a person who goes through their Jewish life, their entire journey in Avodas Hashem, in what we call mitzvahs anashim milumada, completely rote mechanistic life? How good is that? It's pathetic. We're not looking for a life that's just based on kaf aleim har kegigis. It's no good. But what's more is that this whole idea of coercion and the system of Beis Din, when you scratch the surface a little bit, you'll notice something very odd. Take a look on the next Gemara, back on the other page. You know, let's look at this Mishnah in Makos number 13. The Mishnah says in Makos, end of the first parak, Sanhedrin, if you have a rabbinic court, ha-horeges echad b'shavua, that puts someone to death, sends somebody off a building, or kills them in one of the four methods of capital punishment, once in 7 years, that's nikreis chavlonis. It's called destructive. Seven. Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria Omer, echad l'shivim shana. He says once in 70 years. And then they have a debate as to whether that is an effective deterrent or not. But wait a second. Why is that? Why is it that if a rabbinic court only carries out a death sentence once in 7 years or 70 years, that's called a murderous Beis Din? Because do you know, if you look in the Mishnayos and Sanhedrin, there are a lot of very peculiar particulars about the Maisa Beis Din. If you hold somebody into court for killing somebody, you know that to give them the death penalty, you have to have two witnesses. Not only that, the witnesses have to warn the person. Not only that, the person has to be what's called yatir atzmo lamisa. The person has to say, I'm going to do this action with the knowledge that that will bring my death in the rabbinic court. So that's step one. That's hurdle number one in the legal process. Then you haul them in there. You get the two witnesses. So you sit the witnesses down. You have what's called drishas and chakiras, bedikos. You have questions. You ask them what color shoes he was wearing. You ask him how long his tzitzis were. What kind of baseball cap he was wearing. What the sun looked like that day. What tree was he standing next to. By the time you finish with these eidim, they probably walk out of there like a bunch of zombies. They don't know which way is up and which way is down. And it's true with many areas of Hilchos Eidos that the particulars make it so difficult to convict someone and to actually mete out what is legislated as a punishment. It's hard to know how often they did or didn't ever, observe this phenomenon in reality. It's hard to know. Therefore, the Bezdin is given a certain amount of latitude for extra legal measures of enforcement. But the strict law is very odd. If the Rambam is telling us and Hashem wants us to set up a strict law that is coercive and implemented, why would it give us all of these details that basically make it virtually impossible to actually implement it? If it's supposed to be there, let it be there. Don't you ever hear the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about something called a ben sorer umora, a wayward son? The Gemara finishes, by the time it finishes with all the details, that the mother and the father have to be the same height. They have to have the same timbre of their voice. They have to look the same way. They have to have X number of assets, so he steals this kind of food and drinks that kind of wine. By the time you're finished, the Gemara says, ben sorer umora, lo hoya velo nivre. Nishke shtoige, nishke floige. Never happened. Never happened. Because it's impossible. It's impossible to follow all of the details. So I'm not understanding. I thought we're supposed to be coercive. We're supposed to be enforcers. And the last point, the fourth of these observations, comes from a story in Sefer Malachim. Malachim Beis. I put this on the Mar Mekomo sheet just because I thought it was hilarious. What happens when you Google Yoshiyahu? That is Yoshiyahu. You're looking at him. He looks great. Boy king. This is what it says in Wikipedia. This is what he looks like. So apparently that's what it is. I couldn't help myself. Parents, Amon, not a good guy. Yoshiyahu in Malachim Beis in Perek Chav Gimel, the Pasuk describes that there was no one like him. There was no one more righteous than he who precipitated a total Baal Tshuva movement, a total reformation to come back to the Dvar Hashem. No one did it more than Yoshiyahu, who ever preceded him. He was the greatest of all the righteous kings who preceded him. You know, he was a boy king who grew up in a time and a place that was completely barren of Yiddishkeit. They didn't even know what a Sefer Torah looked like. They brought him a Sefer Torah. He says, I don't know what to do. Call Yirmiyahu. Call Hulda. Call somebody. We didn't know what a Torah looked like. And he transforms everything. He does the Korban Pesach, which is the symbol of the bris. And he eradicates Avodah Zarah. And then what happens? He takes on a man by the name of Paro. He's coming from Egypt. He's going to fight the Assyrians. He's got nothing to do with Yoshiyahu. But Yoshiyahu comes out to meet him in a battle, and he loses badly, and Yoshiyahu himself is going to be pierced with 300 arrows, Chazal say. And he's going to be eulogized this coming Sunday, unless the Mashiach comes first, with a special kina from Yirmiyahu. He was such a righteous man, he gets a kina ledoroson from Yirmiyahu. It's unbelievable. So how did he meet such an untimely and gruesome demise? So Chazal, Rashi quotes it there, and say from Malachim, say that he made a mistake, he made a calculation that was wrong. The Pasuk says, V'cherev lo savor ba'artzachem. No sword should pass through your land. So Yoshiyahu said, wait a second. You, Pharaoh Necho, you're living in Egypt down there. You want to take on Assyria. By the way, this is going to be the Battle of Carchemish, which is going to turn the tide soon after Syria, Assyria, Ashur. They're going to be replaced by Bavel. So this is a very historic juncture. Do you want to go from down there to fight the Chevra up there? You can't go through my land. You should go around. Why? Because the Pasuk says, V'chever, v'cherev lo sabar ba'artzachem. No sword will pass through your land. And Yoshiyahu interpret that even for peaceful measures. No sword. So Yoshiyahu says, stop. And he says, no way. Yoshiyahu says, we have no problem. Because people are religious. That verse, V'cherev lo sabar ba'artzachem, no sword will come into your land, is when people are observing the Dvar Hashem. He says, we have people all over the land. Everybody is observant. Everybody is Shomer Torah mitzvahs. So we have a haftacha, a divine promise. Says the righteous King Yoshiyahu, who turned the nation upside down in tshuva, says the Gemara in Tanis, number 14. My drosh, what did Yoshiyahu darshan the pasuk v'chev elu sava ba'artzachem? My cherev, ilay mecherev, she'ena shal shalom. Is it a war? It's v'chsiv anasati shalom. Or it's elafilu shal shalom. But what's the problem? Says the Gemara, "Vahu eino yodea she'ein doro dome yafeh." He didn't realize that he had sentries going. He had mashkichim and tznius police, anti-avodazara police, going to every home, knocking on doors. They open the door. They don't see any getchkalach. No idols, no icons, no crosses, no Marys, no nothing. But what they don't see is when they open the door, there's something behind the door. So they close the door, and there is your local deity hanging on the hook on the back of the door. So what do I learn from this? That the truth is, Chazal are trying to tell us something. The secret is that religious coercion and enforcement, it doesn't even work. No one had more influence and authority than Yoshiyahu. And he thought he got it right, but he didn't. Who knew he didn't get it right? Yirmiyahu knew he didn't get it right. Yirmiyahu only knew he didn't get it right because he was a prophet. You can't hide things from a prophet. So the Gemara says he should have called Yirmiyahu on the phone and said, are we qualifying for this promise? And Yirmiyahu would have said, no. What you don't can't see, what you don't know, is that people in their basement are worshiping idols. Yoshiyahu said, I didn't see that. I sent cops to every neighborhood. So I'm trying to put the pieces of this puzzle together. On the one hand, Chazal and the tradition seems to tell us that religious coercion is an essential component of Yadus, and that we have to do this and someone's going to enforce it. On the other hand, we see that, number one, that's not what it means to be human, and that's not what it means to be a Jew. Nasa v'nishma is essential to the covenant. Number two, if it's all about coercion, it's lacking, it's missing. There's a modal rabba. It's just going through the motions. Number three, it's a mechanism which has so many holes like Swiss cheese, it's not practical to implement. And number four, even if you could implement it, it's not going to be successful. So how do we address this challenge? Why should we be observant? And I think the answer, in one word, is relationship. The pasuk tells us on the bottom here, in number 15, way at the end of the Chumash, Ha'idosi b'chem hayom es ha'shemayim v'es ha'aretz es ha'chayim v'hamav es nasati l'fanecha ha'bracha v'ha'klala u'bacharta b'chayim l'mantich ya'ata v'sarecha. The Rabbeinu Shalom tells us that what he wants to see is us make a good choice. Us make a choice to choose life. That is the goal. He's going to lay it out of the Chaim and the Maves, the life and the other side, the Bracha and the Klala, the blessing and the other, God forbid. And what he tells us is he doesn't say, do good, do right, do life. He says, choose life. Because it's all about a relationship with him, with a capital H. You ever have the situation, maybe you're on a family WhatsApp group, which I'm not for specific technical reasons, but I would gladly join the WhatsApp group of the Kanner Gross Mishpacha, but this is not WhatsApp friendly. You're in a family WhatsApp group, or you're not on a family WhatsApp group, but somebody texts you, tomorrow is so-and-so's birthday. Or better, it's 11:15 at night and someone texts you, today was so-and-so's birthday. And you're like, wait a second, it's 11:15 Central Time, it's 12:15 Central Eastern Time, is it still his birthday? If for me it's his birthday, I can still text him, it'll still count, but for him it's not his birthday anymore. When we get that text, the happy birthday text, after we know that everybody on the family WhatsApp group, and then they got the parallel family WhatsApp group, so you don't know, but you know because everyone's texting you at the same time. You know that one kind soul reminded you to text that person. How does that feel? It's nice. It's good. It's okay. But you know what's much nicer? When the person remembers on their own. We don't text you at midnight.
And it's obvious, patently obvious, that before you went to sleep, somebody maybe next to you says, did you call so-and-so for their birthday? You say, oh, darn. And Amazon Prime will not save you by that point. If you're in a relationship with somebody and it matters to you, it should come from you. It should come from us. And when it comes from somebody else nudging you to do it, there's something missing. Our connection to God is supposed to be a relationship. And we need to build that relationship. And that's why, at the core of it, the Nasav and Ishma, the choice, is what is essential. But at the same time, if you turn the page, turn the packet to the back, building a relationship is not all about choice. And this is borne out not just by our intuition, our common sense, and our experience, but also by the research. And, as very often we like to joke, our great mentor, our teacher, Dr. David Pelkovitz. So when Dr. Pelkovitz, I'll call him about something, and says, oh, the research says. So part of me is saying, when he says the research says, is he just making it up? No, did he ever actually read the research? So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to find some of that research. So thanks to the internet, you can find your own research. Don't worry. You don't have to just take his word for it. Let's start with the left one. Commitment to one's spouse as a predictor of marital quality among older couples. Indiana University Northwest and Purdue. The present study examined the relationships between several independent variables and three marital quality variables in a community sample of 72 married couples age 50 and up. Commitment to the spouse was the strongest and most consistent predictor of marital quality. Commitment was negatively related to marriage problems and positively related to expression of love and dyadic adjustments. The other independent variables were generally unrelated to marital quality. More recent study. Commitment to the relationship is related to the quality of the relationship. It makes sense that people who commit themselves to a relationship are more likely to find rewards than those who invest sporadically or half-heartedly. This article reviews the various dimensions of commitment in intimate relationships, including commitment as an attraction, commitment as a moral obligation, etc. We know this in our kishkas, and we see it, that to build a true relationship must include an element of commitment. And that's why an ultimate relationship, which is given to us by Chazal in the form of a marriage contract, requires commitment. It requires a formal, procedural commitment. And perhaps in this light we can understand that everything that we said, all of the quote-unquote coercive elements, they're not actually coercive. They are expressions of a commitment. They express the idea that we are in a committed relationship and we can't just decide one day if we feel like it, if we don't feel like it. These quote-unquote coercive elements express the idea that we're in this relationship whether we feel like it or not. Whether we're in the mood for it or not, because that is a true relationship. A relationship between two people who are committed to each other doesn't depend on whim or feeling. You know, I don't feel like putting on tefillin today. I don't feel like it. I don't want to mess up my hair. You notice it gets, you know, the part gets all sedate when you put on the tefillin in the morning. But you know what? If you're in a relationship with someone and you're committed to them, and you have a mutual contract, it doesn't really matter whether you feel like it or not. Because that's what it means to be committed to someone. That's what a real relationship is about. The truth is, now that we think about it, all of these commitment ideas, they're all what we would call in halacha bidyeved. They're all post facto. They're all not ideal. Because you know what the ideal is? I should wake up in the morning and say, oh, I want to do something for that person. I want to take this relationship to the next level. But you know what? Every relationship has, you know, rough spots. So to manage those rough spots, we have commitment. That's why for many people who are, using marriage as an example, who are committed in a marriage relationship, they wear a ring. You don't need a ring when things are good. You need to look at your ring when it's not so good, because that reminds you that there was a time when we made a commitment. And so we're going to stick with it in this commitment. If that's where we are in our life, if we are committed to each other right now, that's what we're going to do. So the idea of being committed, it's not a stira to volition. And the truth is, if you put in a bracket, you can even add a nuance to this, which appears in the next source in 16 in the Hafla. He was a great rabbinic German luminary in the end of the 17th century, in the 1600s, into the 18th century. I'm sorry, into 18th century, into the 19th century. He died in, I think, around 1806 or something. He says, what is the pshat vayisyatzvu b'sachti sahar? He says, there are two kinds of relationships. Go to the fourth line. Al das hapshuta ki ha'inyan ha'ava yischalik l'shnei panim. Ha'echad avas ish esre'eu lasos ritzonu l'malas asher yishal mimenu. Sometimes you're in a relationship, which is a positive relationship, and somebody asks you for something, you do it for them. You have a friendship, you have a neighbor, so you're in a relationship with your neighbor. They ask you, can you please take up my mail when I'm on vacation? So they take in your mail. He calls that ahavas ratzon, levad. People who, they like each other, they love each other, they get along. So I have to l'recha kamocha, so to speak. I love my neighbor. He asked me to take in the mail. Great. I asked him, can you drive on my driveway when it's snowing so people think that I'm home? Great, no problem. But that's not a committed relationship. I don't feel that I'm obligated to take in his mail. But there's another. There is what he calls v'habez, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down in the middle, hu avas av lebeno, a parent's love for a child, ava atzmis, essential, committed love. There are certain close relationships. Those are inherent love, inherent relationships. And those involve an element of coercion. I see my 2-year-old or 4-year-old wander out into the street. I don't say to them, you know, you have Bechira Chafshis, according to the Meshech Chachma, so you can decide, do you want to wander into the middle of Church Street on Shabbos afternoon or not? It's Bechira Chafshis. No way! It's because of love that I pick up that kid and I give him, according to the Rambam, you don't get angry, you just feign anger. Not so easy all the time, depending on which kid. And you say, you don't go in the street, do you hear me? And you scare them. And you pick them up and you schlep them back. And they should understand that the street is not a place for a 4-year-old. It's dangerous. They're not Bechira Chafshis for that. So he says, the Rabbeinu Shalom loves us so much that certain things he doesn't give us Bechira Chafshis. Because he knows our soul. He knows what we're destined for greatness in Olam Haba. So he guides us. And he doesn't give us a choice to walk and play in the middle of traffic. It's kind of a nuance in the concept of commitment in the reverse. He is committed to us in such a way that he wants to make sure that we don't harm ourselves. But at the end of the day, that point notwithstanding, now that we refresh our perspective, perhaps, we can understand that now it makes sense why the Beis Din has so many loopholes. Because it's not l'chatchila. It's meant to be a bidyeved fallback. It is an essential part of the relationship that there is commitment. But it's not what we're aiming for, striving for. We're going to give you every loophole in the book to make sure that we don't have to do that. That's only if something went wrong and we need to do whatever, okay, we need to rely on that. But ideally, that's not what we're looking for. And we know that's not a way to effectively run a relationship anyway. What kind of a relationship is there if you have to constantly police the other person if they're committed to you? That's not a relationship at all. That's why it's not effective. Policing only works for certain concepts or certain behaviors or certain practices. It doesn't work in a relationship. It's just a fallback, you could argue, as a motivator. We're supposed to be motivated by ourselves because of the relationship. If we're not inherently motivated, so you got to find some other motivation. And sometimes it's not always the most pleasant. It is what it is. But if you're in a relationship, you got to be committed. And I wonder, you could suggest a proof to this is an interesting halachic principle at the end of the page in source number 17. Adahachi aisyu lau gavra. The Gemara describes how they brought a guy in. Delo have a mokir avua v'ime. That he was not adequately honoring his mother and father, which according to Chazal is one of the tallest tasks out there. Although if you have, you know, guests like ours, kibud av va'em is the easiest thing to do. We just try to live up to that. It's a great schus. Amar luhu, so you know what he said back to him, shavku, leave him alone. You can't coerce people into kibud av va'em. Why not? So Gemara says a rule, very interesting. Titania, we have a braisa. Kol mitzvah saseh shematan schor betzida. Any positive commandment where in the text, immediately adjacent to that, they give you the name, the list, the identity of the reward, the Beis Din doesn't coerce. Interesting. So since it says, and kibud av va'em, do kibud av va'em say that you will live long. So kibud av va'em is the mitzvah, living long is the reward. So the Beis Din says, we're not going to coerce you. Let him go. Ah, he didn't fulfill a mitzvah, and the Beis Din is supposed to enforce mitzvahs? No, certain kind of mitzvahs you don't enforce. You don't do it. Why not? So there was a great rabbinic luminary. His name was Rav Chaim Chizkiyahu Medini. He authored in the 19th century an encyclopedia of halachic terminology. It's called Stei Chemed. Chemed sounds like Chizkiyahu Medini. So he quotes from the Halakha of Yosef Shol Nathanson of Lemberg, who has an awesome shot, number 18. He says, "V'tzorach lomar, you know what you have to say? Tekevan dematan schar betzida pshita dekaiminon. If the Torah tells you black on white what the merit is, we establish, we know, pshita, it's obvious, diyakaimena, of course he's going to fulfill it. Because it says right there, the motivation. And therefore, you don't need a Beis Din to coerce the guy. Because obviously he's going to do it, because it says black on white, the reward. And he gives you a proof. Somebody who's obligated to bring chai ve'achatos v'ashamos ein memashkinosam. Somebody is obligated to bring a korban chatas. They did a sin that requires atonement that can only be achieved by bringing a korban chatas. So usually, do you know if you have to give something to the Beis HaMikdash in certain circumstances, they will take some collateral because they want to make sure you're going to pay up. Imagine if when the shul people came around, and now it's membership season, if every time somebody left the shul, they went to the bathroom, the gabbai stole their talis and said, we're going to give you the talis back when you pay membership. That's one effective way of getting people on board. I don't know if they don't do that. Young Israel, West Rogers Park. No. Just checking. So in the Beis Din, they would do that on occasion, but not if you were chai of a carbon chatas. Why not? Because nobody in their right mind would miss a chance to bring a carbon chatas and repair their relationship with Hashem. So there was no need to coerce the person. They knew on their own. So says the Yad Shol, that's the pshat in this Gemara. Beis Din only steps in when we think that people are going to forget to be motivated. Because it's all about a relationship. Matan schar betzida is the idea that the motivation is in front of your eyes. Coercion is when you're not adequately motivated, but that's only b'diavad. So I'll close with an illustration. Our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is about a relationship, and cultivating that relationship can't be about coercion. But it needs to require an element of commitment, such as if you were in a relationship with someone, imagine just a theoretical case, and somehow, you don't know exactly how this evolved as such, but there was a rule in this relationship. It doesn't appear in the Mishnayos and Ksubas about interpersonal relationships in a marriage, but let's say you were tasked with taking out the garbage. And that was your job. You don't know exactly where that started, but that became your job. You were informed that that was your job. You are going to take out the garbage. So that's my job. That's what I'm going to do. And when you're in a relationship, certain things you just have to do, especially because very often in some relationships, the other person does 98%. So 2% you can do. So sometimes you really do not feel like taking out the garbage. So sometimes the other person has to actually say, please take out the garbage. Did you notice it was spilling onto the kitchen floor? And sometimes, not ideal, again, just reality speaking, theoretically, you get off the couch and you start muttering. As you're going toward the garbage, you're muttering. You get the garbage thing, you tie the top of the bag, you take it out to the garbage, and you're still muttering when you throw it in the garbage. That's one way of fulfilling your commitment. Another way of fulfilling your commitment is when the other person says, would you please take out the garbage? You notice that it's overfilling. You say, sure, I'd love to take out the garbage, no problem. Because in that split second of seichel, you realize that person does so much, I could never even adequately repay them. And this is nothing but a schmeck of a speck of gratitude that I can convey. So you get off the couch and you take out the garbage. But you know what's really good? What's really good is that before the person comes into the kitchen and sees that the garbage looks like a disaster, you go over with a shtick seichel. Not all men have this intuitively. We have to cultivate it. You go over and you take out the garbage on your own. Then you go and you take the thing, you throw it in the bin, and you say, ah, I did something good. You know when it's mahadrin, mina mahadrin? When you go back inside, you take out from under the sink the plastic bag and replace it on your own. That is a mitzvah b'shleimusa. So that's what it is. Our commitment to the Ribono Shel Olam is just that. Sometimes, maybe we don't feel like it, but we have to do it. That's part of a relationship. But the truth is that sometimes, even when we're muttering, when we're going out and we drop that bag in the can, and we're cold and we're tired and we're not interested in going outside, it's just an opportunity to reflect and say, you know what, the truth is, I hate taking out the garbage in this circumstance. But you know what? What an opportunity. What an opportunity if you can get yourself together in your slippers at that moment and say, this is an opportunity to express my commitment to that person. Because if everything that that person does for me, it's the least I can do. And I'm actually glad. I appreciate the fact that I have to do this, because otherwise, God forbid, our relationship might deteriorate. If there wasn't that hard line that kept me in line, maybe if I didn't feel like it, I wouldn't do it, and then who knows where it would go. So in a certain sense, the obligations are there to help nurture and foster the relationship that we all want to build, we all seek to build, with the Ribono Shel Olam in our lives. Thank you very much.